The E-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order. Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Capitol for our third week here. Today we have a presentation by on the PS Minnesota proposal, and some of you may have heard it before out at the Sheridan, but it goes back to when Governor Pawlenty originally, I suppose now about 3 years ago, set up a group to look at the education finance system in the state of Minnesota. And the approach was to set up a fairly large number of people, broke them up into groups, and then actually had them kind of represent the different segments of education from the perspective of the local district, educators, administrators, anyway, a cross-section. And that charge was to come back with recommendations, and before the final recommendations came back, it was kind of hurried up. They had they brought back information, but it really wasn't kind of the specific recommendations that many of us were looking for. And so last year, 2 years ago, this committee tried to fund the continuation of that and get that those recommendations, and that was not enacted or passed into law. Then last year, many of the organizations that will be presenting here today picked up a portion of that financing of that last segment and went ahead and did that. And so that's where we are today, and I'm happy to, I don't know who I should turn it over to Mr. Dresden. I'll turn it over to you, and you can introduce the others.
Actually, I think we'll do this the opposite, if that's
okay.
Fine, Senator Stumpf.
All right.
Senator Stumpf, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to spend some time with you this morning. Greg Vondell is my name. I'm school superintendent from Sauk Rapids Rice. And if I appear a bit out of breath, I'm sorry, as I raced across campus. We had fully intended to be here by about 8:30 to be set up. Senator Clark, when I drive in like this, I understand why where we live is called Greater Minnesota.
Exactly.
It felt like a greater place to be this morning. When I hit 694, I understood it was going to be a difficult time. Senator Stumpf and the committee, what we intend to do today is a modified version of something that we presented at several different venues. In full presentation, this was done, as you'd indicated, on December 1st at an education policy forum, and we invited many of you, actually, I think all of you were invited to that. Many of you were able to be a part. But we don't intend to present in the pure sense of presentation today. What we intend to do is to offer you some information and engage in a dialogue. As a matter of fact, we used the same approach on Friday, or actually on Thursday afternoon this last week at the Minnesota School Board Association conference, and found that that exchange was a very, very good one. I would invite you all along the way this morning, if you have questions about anything that we're talking about, please feel free to jump in. You're not going to disrupt a flow of presentation because, as I suggested, we're here to exchange information and engage in dialogue. I'm going to be joined today by the individuals who were a part of our December 1st event. We'll start with Rick Dresden, who will share some more information about what Senator Stumpf referred to a moment earlier, the Governor's Task Force on Education Finance Reform. And we do have PowerPoint presentations and the handouts associated with those presentations. Hopefully we made enough for members in the audience as well as for the committee chairs. We will then move to a brief review, current status and preview, so to speak, past, present, and future of this initiative, done by three members of what are considered to be the executive committee for this coalition that comes before you today. When we're done with those presentations, I'll spend some time walking through the PowerPoint presentation we put together on behalf of PS Minnesota, which really outlines a new funding framework. And it's the funding framework, well, that will be the focus of our discussion today. But as I suggested all along the way, you take us any direction you wish us to go. With that in mind, I would like to introduce Rick Dressen, who most of you probably know. Dr. Dressen is the superintendent of the Edina schools, and prior to that was with the Alexandria schools. And Rick and I go way back into Central Minnesota undergraduate school together. And Rick is a fine person and was the chair of the governor's task force and has offered the opportunity to share insights into that task force. And we'll just move into Rick's presentation. Okay.
Mr. Dressen.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, it's an honor to be here to play historian. See that as my role today, and you're probably very aware that there have been several studies taking a look at school finance reform. The one that I chaired was the governor's task force, as Senator Sump mentioned, and it was a journey that began and completed its report in July of 2004. It was a 19-member task force, very diverse members. I think that's what it needed to be, representation from all segments of the state of Minnesota, not just education, but just across the board. It was a marvelous dialogue. It was something that, as I mentioned before, I don't think we send Christmas cards to each other because we are so diverse. I mean, our perspectives are very diverse. Our expectations are very diverse, but our mission was the same, and that kept us together, and that was the charge of the task force, was to say, can we develop some recommendations to better serve our young people through finance and the finance funding formula? We received extensive help from the Department of Education as well as our consulting firm that was contracted by the governor's office, Department of Ed, Management Analysis and Planning, MAP. And their point person was Jim Guthrie. Our task force met 9 times over 7 months. And so part of the challenge we had is trying to meet those expectations. And I think there were hopes that we would drive forward a funding formula that we really could examine as a state. But we were limited on time. We were limited on what we were able to accomplish as 19 task force members and the limits of that we had with contracting with MAP. But really our key action as we move forward was to create a sense of urgency, to help the state understand, because there had been several studies done in the past, but that we needed to say, yes, we can do better in funding formula. And I'm going to run through these rather rapidly because I think the dialogue following my presentation probably will be just as valuable, but I do want to give you a snapshot. We were able to develop some recommendations that we felt very strong about, and you'll see how they dovetail with the work of PS Minnesota. We felt that the funding needed to be linked to student learning, that we needed to bring accountability to a higher level, whole thought of keeping community and educators involved, thought of continuing to value choice in education, that we needed to make sure the funding was sustainable so that we could expect and be able to plan for it and easily understandable. Our probably line of the week with the recommendations was it was a rationally determined, learning-linked, student-oriented, and has cost-based instructional services that would account for student characteristics and unique cost factors. We wanted that to be our driving force, and that truly was one of our strong recommendations that we brought forward, that we felt we could do better in that arena. We thought we could do more of block funding so we could be more responsive as education is in a rapid mode change and that we wouldn't get caught up in categorical funding areas. We still wanted to have voter-approved levies. We also felt the possibility of having something with innovation so that we could be creative, again, to be responding to the changes. We did, as Senator Sump mentioned, had three groups of educators get together and take a look at, is this possible to come up with a funding formula of this approach? And working with MAP, again, we use the professional judgment panel approach. And I don't know if that will be touched on further, but it's an approach of really driving the learning and linking it with funding. And it was bringing educators together to design a school that K through 12, a school district of averages, saying this is what we need to meet the standards and the expectations for a complete K-12 education experience for learners. So it was very strong that way. It was macroed out from a cost standpoint. So we were looking at funding from 2001-02. Some of the things that it did not address was transportation, special ed, or debt services. We just couldn't go that deep. In the end, what we were able to do is to make a recommendation, to sort through the information, to say that this approach could be successful, that we could come up with a system that would do that, but we recognize it was only the first step. As 19 members, that's about as far as we could go on a macro level. We were able to determine it was someplace between 2.8% less of K-12 funding statewide to 6.89 in additional amounts of funding. What we then proposed was next steps. We wanted the journey to go forward, and I believe it was 2 years ago that I was at this committee just giving an update and asking for the committee to move forward with the study. We felt the follow-up was important. We felt the sense of urgency was very important, and we wanted to celebrate any progress we made. And the Department of Education and I believe the legislature and the governor's office have made some steps on accountability, and even this dialogue, I think, enhances the possibility of moving forward with the recommendations of our efforts. I think it's important that we stay focused on the students and their future. And so those became the recommendations of the task force. What I learned through the process was the deep passion Minnesota has for public education. I cannot even begin to guess the number of presentations I put on as chair of the task force following our work with people giving a variety of questions, lots of thoughts and ideas, but the bottom line was they do feel we can do a better job of funding public education, and the passion was from every corner of the state, no matter the people that we talked to, that passion for our young people and their educational future was strong. The thought of saying we can create a 21st century funding formula through vision, through creativity, through collaboration, and it is going to take a lot of hard work of all of us working together. Litigation cannot be an answer. So that's why I really appreciate the work of PS Minnesota. That's why I appreciate the work of your efforts here today to listen to this story and to get to work on it. And I know that with educational and political leadership, it is possible. It was an exciting journey that we began in 2003, and it's fun to be at this point of the journey as we move forward. So with that, that would conclude the history of the task force. I'm going to be with as long as I can, but I do have a commitment back in the district, so I may not be available for all the questions at the end of the hearing. But I, again, thank you for this time. I thank you for your willingness to hear the story. I encourage you to support it as we journey forward as a state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dresden. And who do we...
We pause in case there are questions for Rick at this point in time about this really is the foundation upon which we have built, we as PS Minnesota. We're going to jump into what PS Minnesota is here in just a second. But if there are questions regarding the task force specifically, Rick is the best person to answer those. I could make something up, but he could answer it for real. So.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one very quickly. At the end of the meetings, at the end of this particular group, how much consensus did you have for the conclusions within this report?
From the task force?
Yes.
The task force did have a minority report. The task force as a group did agree to the recommendations, and then after we had finalized the recommendations, we did have two members of the task force that did put a minority report in with some concerns of saying we weren't creative enough to get out of the box, as I recall it. But I think overall... there was a support for the general concepts.
Thank you. I think we'll move along. Superintendent?
Thank you, Senator Sumpf. Thank you, committee. What I'd like to do now is to introduce three individuals who serve as the executive committee for PS Minnesota. Brad Lundell of Schools for Equity and Education, Scott Kroonquist of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and not an executive director, but a chief lobbyist for the Minnesota Rural Education Association is Sam Walseth. And the three of them will share a bit of the journey from how we got to from the governor's task force to the present. We're going to start with Brad.
Brad.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education. And by starting out, I want to say thank you to this committee. It's always been very, very supportive of these efforts, going back to listening, I think, when John Myers did the first report, not only the first phase of the report, but the report that was commissioned by C that I'll talk about in a bit. The policy fora were before Christmas, and so we used to use I was the ghost of Christmas past, and Scott's the ghost of Christmas present, and and Sam's the ghost of Christmas yet to come, but now that we're past the holiday season, I guess I'm ancient history, Scott is current events, and Sam is Futurama. So I guess that's how we'll be proceeding today. Before I start my comments, I just wanted to say, just last week or so, I picked up an old copy of John Kenneth Galbraith's The Affluent Society. And in that book, there's very powerful, some very powerful words and very powerful depictions of society that was written in the 1950s. And John Kenneth Galbraith coined the term the conventional wisdom. And the one thing that comes out of that, there's a very powerful passage in there, talks about how ideas alone don't change conventional wisdom, but the circumstances, when circumstances change, then the conventional wisdom changes along with them. And I think we've come to a point in our history, and especially as education contributes to ongoing history, that we now have a change in the conventional wisdom. And I think what John Myers has done here, also following up on what was done in the Governor's Task Force, is some big changes that we have to look at as we redesign our education system. As Rick said, we started out, in Schools for Equity Education, looking at the Governor's Task Force, participating in that task force in 2003. I wouldn't say we were disappointed with the results of that task force, but we saw that there were some unanswered questions. And so in 2004, upon the release of that report, C alone contracted with John Myers to do kind of a review of the Governor's Task Force. And John did that review, and that review was presented to this committee in January of 2005. But in that report, John said, here are some of the things that are good about the report. Here are some things where some more work needs to be done.
Mr. Lundell, just for the information of committee members who do not know John Myers, could you just give a brief explanation of who he is?
No, Mr. Chair, I certainly will. John Myers is a nationally renowned school finance expert. I think if you go do a Google search of John Myers in education finance, you'll see a lot of work done by John Myers and John Augenblick, Robert Palash. They've worked in almost every state in the union. They've done adequacy studies, equity studies, studies of various elements of the education system. John works a lot with charter schools. He's worked a lot with national standards. Again, he's a very highly respected member of the education study community. He's a former legislator from Kansas. I believe he worked for ECS and NCSL as well. Again, he's someone I think that has a tremendous amount of respect within the education funding community. So after 2004, and again in 2005, as Senator Stumpfline laid out, this committee had an appropriation to take the Governor's Task Force report, run it through several analysis screens, and then come back with further detail as to what the recommendations would be or should be. That did not, as Senator Stumpf said, that did not become part of the final legislation in 2005. And so in the summer of 2005, Schools for Equity reached out to its partners in the Association of Metropolitan School Districts and the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and once again contracted with John Myers to look more deeply into the governor's study and to come up with a number. It's kind of the gap in what funding was in Minnesota and then what it should be to meet state and national standards. I think the one thing to point out here is state and national standards are, this is happening nationally now because you're seeing, used to be the old chicken and egg argument between legislators and the education interests that how much money do you need? Well, a little bit more or a little bit, or we're going to give you this or we're going to give you that. There was no real definition as to what it took for school districts throughout the state to meet the national standards. And I think that what John Myers and others have done nationally, and I think this was also done with Jim Guthrie in the Governor's Task Force, is to come up with these are what the costs would be given what the standards, assuming these standards, this is what the cost structure needs to be. We came then in December of 2005, we released our report that showed a $1 billion gap or $952 million gap between what was being spent in Minnesota and what the what was projected as being needed. We felt still, though, that we needed to go further and run. That was only done with the professional judgment panels that were done, done under the guidelines of what the governor had put out in those panels. We then moved forward with that, saying we want to go look at the other studies, other ways of studying, and there's other models to do that. I think Greg will be talking about that a little bit. But the successful schools model, the evidence-based model, and the statistical analysis model. And so we moved on to phase two, where we were joined, where this executive committee was joined by a greater number of education interests. And those folks are listed on the PS Minnesota background or on the back page. And you'll see there the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Minnesota Administrators of Special Education, School Board Association, both the principals organizations and parent organizations, Parents United and the Minnesota Parent Teacher Organization. So I guess that's where I'm going to turn it over to Scott, because I think that we've come up now with another set of studies, and those studies were then released in the policy forum, and we'll be talking about those in greater detail. But I'll turn it over to Scott to talk about where we're at now.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and thank you very much for this hearing. As Brad mentioned, we've had a lot of comments. We've done this presentation several times now in front of many groups. And at the end, we always get comments about how the three of us are together, testifying together, and kind of seem to be on the same page. A lot of people are surprised about that and kind of, they're used to seeing us fight and squabble and bicker. And they say, how has that come about? And, I think maybe the best analogy is the joke about the man that kept hitting himself in the head with the hammer. Another guy came up and said, why are you doing that? And the guy said, because it feels so good when I stop. And, it's kind of what we're feeling like. It's been nice to actually sit down and work together because we're all tired, I think, of the current system, which really does seem to put us at odds so often. And we're tired of being at the end of a legislative session and it seems to come down to, we're going to tweak the sparsity formula a little bit, and then that means we got to do a little something on the referendum cap, and then, of course, we got to adjust some of the equity formulas. And then in the end, none of us feel very good about it. I don't think any of you generally feel good about it either. We're kind of left wanting more. And usually, as a result, we end up having school districts have to go out and pass a referendum that fall. And this last fall really points to the danger of that when 60% of the referendums across the state failed. And, of course, that leaves communities in a real bind and school districts and ultimately, of course, and most importantly, our students in a real bind. So for the last couple years, we have been working together on the PS Minnesota effort. We've had a couple of parallel efforts moving forward. We've had a subcommittee that's really worked on trying to come up with some formula recommendations based on the data and the research provided by John Myers and his firm. And then we've also had another subcommittee working on more of the public relations standpoint of it, trying to help educate parents and school officials and our policymakers about the work of the Myers firm. And so that brings us really to where we are today. That's how PS Minnesota evolved. We do have a website up and running, psminnesota.org. If you haven't had a chance, I would encourage you to go to that website. There's a wealth of information there, including the full study by John Myers, as well as an executive summary and many other downloads that you can look at. It's tough work putting together a new formula. You all know that. You've worked on it. Your staff certainly knows that. We had really hoped to come to this legislative session with a much more finished product than we've been able to, but given the delay in some of the research coming to fruition and just the complexity of it, that's something that we're continuing to work on and we're really hoping that we can continue to work on with you. But I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman, and turn it over to my colleague, Sam Walseth from Rural Education Association.
Thank you, Mr. Kroonquist. Mr. Walseth.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Many of you are familiar with Vernay Hasbargen, who's led the charge for MREA for many years. She's put me in charge to handle a lot of efforts this session, so I wanted to introduce myself to you first of all and say that unfortunately you'll have to see me and not a lot of Renee this year. A little bit of background. MREA is an organization governed by school board members, teachers, administrators from across greater Minnesota. It's a pretty unique organization from that regard. We represent about 150 school districts, and while that sounds like a massive amount of school districts, you know, more than Brad or Scott combined, we actually represent the fewest number of real students. We represent a lot of small districts, geographically sparse districts. We have districts who've faced severe decline over in enrollment over the last 5 years. But one thing that continues to guide MREA and its efforts is its governing mission that it always evaluates public policy and finance from a student perspective. How is this policy initiative or finance proposal going to impact the bottom line for student achievement and for our learners? So we always put our learners first. And that's why when Superintendent Von Dell approached us about 2 years ago at one of our board meetings and said, why don't you come and join us on this effort to continue the work of the funding study task force? It's time to take a serious look at a standard-based education system. MREA was very intrigued with that and said, you know, we'll sign up. We'll be partners in this effort. Working toward a rationally linked student-based finance formula is harder than it seems, but it is something we absolutely have to do. And it was interesting, Mr. Chairman, last week during one of your budget overviews, I think it was a question was raised about how on earth did we get to a level of specificity in one of the formulas where the third grader through sixth grader was financed at 1.115? Well, there isn't anything really rational about how we got that other than at the end of the day there was this much money and we backed into it. What this effort is fundamentally about is reshifting the approach we take in developing an education funding system and saying now that we have a standards-based system, we have a lot of research out there nationally that we can start to use to develop our funding formulas instead of saying on May 19th that, well, here's X amount of dollars on the table and we'll just sort of back into our formulas. We like to start from a different perspective and start from a perspective of student needs and the standards we expect them to achieve and go from there to develop our funding formulas. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's just a little bit of why MREA has been on board with this. As Brad said, I get to be Futurama. I have no idea what that really means, but as we've been presenting to parent groups, my spiel has been to convince them to start lobbying you to embrace this proposal. Because really, as Scott mentioned, we've got to the point where we've kind of exhausted a lot of our resources and time and energy trying to get this product to this point. But really, unless the legislature and public policymakers and your staff who has limited time are willing to buy into this effort, you know, it's going to be really hard to get this thing moving, to continue moving it forward. So, Mr. Chair and members, with that, I'm going to conclude, and I hope that we can win you over here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walseth.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that I call Mr. Walseth Futurama because he's the most animated member of our panel.
Well, you've built up our expectations for what you're going to present next.
I'm not certain I'm up to the task, Mr. Chair, but I will give it a try. I'd introduced myself a little bit earlier as being the superintendent for Stock Rapids Rice Schools. So what brings me to a table like this with this group of individuals? In fact, I've had the privilege of testifying before this committee to get, in the past as superintendent of a school district, and you've seen several superintendents in the past. I serve a school district of about 3,800 students, and we're growing. We're in central Minnesota, and we're using a lot of our tax capacity right now to build buildings for growth. Matter of fact, we passed a bond issue about 4 years ago for $60 million, which at that point in time was one of the largest in the state and certainly one of the largest in our area. And we positioned ourselves for continued growth. We expect to have about 5,000 students within the next decade. So that's a magnitude of growth that's significant. What we find ourselves doing, however, is using our tax capacity, so to speak, to build buildings, and we have no tax capacity left to offer programs. We're one of the very few districts in the state that does not have an operating referendum in place. It puts us at more than a bit of a competitive marketplace in our area. And Senator Clark, who represents St. Cloud just across the river from us, understands that we have a considerable attraction to our district, in part because of the way we look and we're a growing suburb and all of that, but we're having a struggle offering the kinds of programs that customers who come to us want to have. ultimately, what I've discovered over a course of nearly a 30-year career is that the Minnesota system of funding schools is inordinately dependent on property wealth, on operating referenda. And I've had a passion against, I'll say this, operating referenda from the very start. Rick and I first met actually in a graduate setting at the University of Minnesota, where I was doing doctoral work, as was he. And the focus of my doctoral dissertation was school funding equity. And so I have some professional background in this as well as a personal stake. I'll say to you as I move into this that I considered before I wanted to be an educator going into a different kind of ministry. As a matter of fact, I was in seminary for several years. And while you might not hear animation in my voice today, but you will hear a bit of passion, and it almost comes across as a little bit of an evangelical kind of thing, because I really have a passion for the children I serve, and I know that the children I serve are at a disadvantage in a system that relies on property wealth as the way to fund schools. What we're going to outline for you today is what we believe to be a better way to fund the schools. You won't find all the details. As a matter of fact, we've worked with some of your staff on the details and recognize that there are holes in some of what we're going to talk about. I'm not so afraid of the fact that there are not all the details in front of you. As a matter of fact, what I invite you to do is to help us poke holes in this and then work together to try to backfill, because we really believe that what we've got is a more rational system, a system that benefits all students. And as we move into this, you're going to find that our central premise is that we should have a funding formula that's linked to student achievement. It's based on research, and it's supported by data. In fact, we have a funding system in place that has some of these elements, but one who sits on the outside would suggest that every year good work is done in committees like this and in places like this. But every year that work is, well-intentioned, not necessarily linked to previous work in a rational fashion. We're really talking about a deconstruction of an existing formula and a reconstruction into a better formula. And we've been using the metaphor of the quilt. Not everything that you're going to see today is going to be cut from new cloth. Some of the pieces will feel pretty familiar. But frankly, the quilt of school funding covers different districts differently across the state, some not so sufficiently. We're suggesting you need to cut that quilt apart, add some new pieces, and put it back in terms of a pattern that in fact fits the entire state. That rational pattern of school funding that meets student needs. It's tied to student success. It's based on research. There are several critical characteristics of a good school funding formula, and we're not the inventors of these. These are in fact in some of our language, but you would find this in the research of good school finance all across the nation. A school finance system that's good targets achievement. It's sensitive to property wealth differentials. It accounts for student and district differences. It permits local discretion. It provides resources to meet capital obligations. It's equalized and provides access to construction in equalized fashion. And it funds a sufficient base that is reduced reliance on levies. And you're going to hear this as a mantra today. Levies. I almost wish I had the sign that had levies in the center with the crossbar, because we really are not a levy group. While in fact many of our districts survive only because of levies, we really believe that we need to reduce reliance on levies. And as we move forward, that's a significant part of this. And we believe that this should be built on an equalized blend of resources. We recognize that in this property tax sensitive environment, some of what we're going to be talking about might not be politically palatable, but we'll suggest to you that in terms of sufficiency and stability, the old foundation built upon the blend of property wealth and state investment was a better system, and most states across the nation have something like that in place. And while we're not here to advocate for that as the key element of this proposal, recognize that that's some of what we see in the background. If we move into the basic funding framework itself, we're going to be talking about three different component parts and then an additional component. The first is a learner component, the second is a district instructional services component, and the third is a district support services component. Now, I've done enough of these presentations to suggest that if you catch the notion that the learner component really is more complex than just a focus on a child, we really only needed to have two components here, because learners come to us with base needs and with differences. And in my presentations, I told stories about the kinds of kids that we all see every day that are just kind of Joe and Sally average kids, and also the kinds of kids that come to us with incredible needs. We recognize that every human being comes with a certain base element of need, and we have a responsibility to meet that. We also understand that some learners come to us with challenges, and we have an obligation in a standards-based system and from a moral perspective to meet those needs as well. The learner component, as we unfold it, will look at both base needs and also special characteristics. Districts come to us in a similar fashion. There are base needs of all districts across the state, infrastructure costs, things like that, and there are unique characteristics of school districts. The very fact that we have three different professional organizations representing three different kinds of schools in the state gives testimony to the fact that there are differences among school districts. And frankly, within each of these three organizations, there are considerable differences that exist even in their membership. The learner component will account for base needs and student characteristics. The district instructional services component is that district characteristics component. The district support services is kind of that base need. And we'll move forward with this. And again, if there are questions at any place along the line, please stop and ask those. The learner component was mentioned a little bit earlier. I don't remember which of the gentlemen suggested it. I think it was Sam talked a little bit about our pupil weighting system in the state of Minnesota. And while it was founded initially on probably some pretty good rationale, we'd argue that the only reason why the foundation formula today is built on student weighting as it is because of the economics of the game. I was a high school principal, and I argued vociferously with my elementary counterpart that it cost more money to run a high school than it did to run an elementary school. But I would suggest to you, we've looked inside that data. We've had meetings with folks like Tom Melcher, who's sitting in the back, and Dr. Melcher would argue that he's got reams of data that would argue the contrary, that in Minnesota, the cost of educating a secondary school student and the cost of educating an elementary school student, by and large, looks pretty much the same. We are operating elementary labs in science just as we are in the secondary school. Our elementary schools are far more equipment and materials intensive than they've ever been. The reason why we have a higher weighting for secondary students, I would argue, than for elementary students is because of the way the math works. If we dropped the weighting system with the current foundation formula, schools would go belly up in the state of Minnesota. The only reason it works is because if you take 1.3 times your current base and you have 1.15 at the elementary level, it all works out in the end to a sum that is considered to be somewhat sufficient. We're suggesting that if you're going to develop a rational formula, that you drop back and count a student as a student. A student as a student. A student that's a baseline individual is a one, whether you're in the secondary school or in the elementary school. And frankly, all of this research that we've done is predicated on kindergarten students as being one as well, because I think almost everybody would advocate that if you're going to set up a system to meet the standards that are in place today and the standards that we are targeting for tomorrow, students need to be in school all day, every day as kindergartners, if the parents and the districts choose. So we're advocating an optional all-day, everyday kindergarten.
Excuse me, Mr. Mandel. One of the discussions in the Higher Education Committee over time has always been the cost of technical programs, in particular, usually lower numbers in classes, higher equipment costs. And one of the components that, in listening to your presentation on it, in December, was you really didn't spend any time talking about the vocational technical kinds of education, and it really, you know, obviously it's only a small component, but it's a component, and I think that higher cost for secondary students, I always thought had some bearing on that.
Mr. Chair, it's an excellent question, and we have not just anticipated the question, but we recognize the cost of the program. And in one of the other two component parts, you will see a placeholder for vocational systems. I would argue, though, that our research is predicated on the inputs based on the outcomes, but we're not into the instructional delivery design. That is not our charge. Matter of fact, our work with John Myers and the APA group would argue that in a state that values local control, the delivery system, the design of that system is really up to the school district. So we're not here to advocate vocational programs or alternative programs or any other delivery system per se. Our research has been predicated on a sufficient sum of money in order to deliver the kinds of system or the kinds of outcomes that the state and the nation require.
Okay, so thank you.
But we'll get to the vocational question specifically in the second and the third learner component.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Van Dell, have you documented what that is that gets us there? Are you only looking at money, or are you looking at, if you're looking at different programs, which are different approaches, they are all equally good in terms of getting to the result?
Senator Olson, our effort has been to take the Governor's Task Force recommendations to the next step. The Governor's Task Force recommendations did not get into the educational design of a system, and PS Minnesota has not moved that direction either. What we've done is we've said, oh, the foundation has been built through the Governor's Task Force. Let's take it to the next step and make a determination about the type of formula that would provide sufficient resources to create effective instructional design.
Okay. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess kind of following up, Mr. Vandal, on Senator Olson's question, it seems as if what you're saying is that there's a direct relationship between how much money is spent and the achievement of students. And I'd like to know what data would support that. I have tried to discover that myself, and even in Minnesota it seems to be all over the map, that it doesn't seem to be how much money it's spent, it's how the money is spent. And what you seem to be telling us is that you're not interested in how it is spent, you're more interested in the amount that gets allocated. And I find that hard to parse, is to say it's really not a function of what we do, it's just how much we spend. And can you give us some, I guess, data that would say that there is a dollar amount that leads to achievement, and what evidence supports that dollar amount, and other states that have done this? I've looked, and I have never seen any relationship established that says spending more money automatically results in better achievement for kids.
Senator Hahn, Mr. Chair, I did not come today prepared to get into the literature of the use of resources, though there is a host of literature in the professional community that would talk about effective use of adequate resources tied to achievement. Our charge was to take the Governor's Task Force to the next level. However, I would instead of offering you data, would suggest that some of the way I hear the question posed is that we have an either-or proposition. We either spend sufficient sums of money regardless of achievement, or we focus on achievement and don't look at sufficient sums of money. What we're arguing with this is that if a state is in the business of establishing standards, then it is rational to look at the cost of delivering those standards. And then the funding system tied to those standards should deliver the sufficient resources in order to achieve. I'm going to switch into a metaphor that I've used in several other settings, and it seems to have worked very well. My father ran a manufacturing business. He was responsible for quality control and production. And he and I, over the course of time, have had many, many conversations about manufacturing. And he understood how to set the costs for his product, because he took a look at the cost of the materials, and he could measure all of the inputs associated with production. And he happened to produce jewel bearings, and so he looked at the machining and the hours of machining and the polishing and all that kind of stuff. And he could put costs to everything. And as a result of that, at the end of the day, put a cost of value on his product. It's called a production function methodology. What we're advocating is a production function methodology in the delivery of educational services as well. We're suggesting there's a lot of ways to deliver, no doubt about that, but here's the target achievement. You know, my dad made jewel bearings. We're supposed to produce kids that are reaching a certain standard. So what we're doing is we're measuring the costs of the inputs associated with that outcome, trying to place some value on it, and creating a formula around it. That is the methodology we're employing. If schools are supposed to be run more like businesses, frankly, this is trying to run the system more like a business.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vandell.
I'm going to continue forward with some of that production function methodology, because the number you're going to see in parenthetical here is a number that Augenblick, Palash, and Associates created out of their production function approach. I believe it was Mr. Kroonquist that talked about several different methodologies for costing out adequate education. The professional judgment panel was the approach that was used by the governor's task force. This number, 5938, is what APA would argue is the number that should have been in the governor's task force had it been taken through to this calculation. Dr. Dressen had indicated earlier that that wasn't the charge of that task force. Their charge was to create a foundation, and we tried to build upon that. We're not here advocating, though I think some people would like us to, that 5938 is what the magic number should be in the school funding formula. What we're here advocating is that some scientific methodology be applied to determining what the base cost should be. 5938 with the professional judgment panel is the number that APA advocates. It's the number we've predicated this on. We're also suggesting that if every student comes out of 5938 or at a 1, if every student comes at base costs, the research would suggest that an adjustment should be made for at-risk kids. The APA research would argue that the adjustment should be at a 0.75. So if you take a student that comes with base costs, base needs, that student is counted as 1. But if a student comes to you that is considered to be at risk, and there are a whole lot of at-risk determiners here, that student is not just a 1, but is a 1.75. So instead of having all secondary students counted as a 1.3 and all third grade students counted as a 1.15, regardless of their needs, we're suggesting all students are counted at 1. And if there's another need associated with that student, in the free and reduced category, the at-risk category, it's another 0.75. That same...
Sure, on this point, Senator.
Yes, thank you, Chair. About 5-6 years ago, I did some looking at one of the components of our education formula dealing with compensatory, and one of the issues was on the free and reduced lunch issue of as a measure. And at that time, it was explained to me that that was the best we had to go on to measure at that time, that it was a proxy. Mm-hmm. And the reason it says proxy is because it is our best guess now at that time. In the intervening years, however, because at that time also, it was told to me that there are better measurements coming online as we, as the use of more standardized testing, we're able to correlate things better, and that there are better things coming online. Now, that was about 5-6 years ago. So now today, we still have now free and reduced proxy on the board. Did your group look at any possible substitutes as a better measurement of at risk rather than just the older measurement?
Mr. Vandell.
Senator Gerlach and Senator Stump, I think Brad Lundell wants to jump in on this because that is an internal debate within our own team, yes. Yeah.
Mr. Lundell.
Senator Stump, Senator Gerlach, I tend to agree with you on this, that, and I think that what Myers, in doing the study, the reason that free and reduced price lunch is used or generally used is because it's very easily obtained. I'll shoot you the paper. It was a great paper on about a year old now. It was featured in Education Week a couple months ago that talks about this very issue. And I do think that as this discussion moves forward and as we talk more today about the need for legislative investment, this is in this process. This is one of the things I think that where the legislature really can dig in and find what is the best proxy for determining what an at-risk student is or a student at risk of not learning and then having that work more closely with actual achievement. I think that you'll find a lot of support within our group, to take that effort. But as John Myers and Doug Rose and Justin Silverstein were doing the study, they were looking at what was going on in other states to measure costs, and free and reduced price lunch is the most readily available, and that's why it was used.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Vandell, you made the statement just a bit ago of the importance of using a scientific basis for identifying this, and I think what Senator Gerlach has raised is that there perhaps has some work in that direction. Is the fact that they have chosen to stay with free and reduced price mean that we don't have a scientific basis for determining that, that that has not been achieved, and so it's what's the easiest and most readily available information is really the basis for it?
Senator, also, Mr. Chair, I would suggest that may be the reason why APA is using that. I indicated a little bit earlier that we're advocating for a rational approach. And while we come to you with what appears to be advocacy for a construct, we're really here talking about a concept. We would embrace the prospect of the kind of study Senator Gerlach would suggest. I believe there are better approaches to this that are more relevant purely for Minnesota. And if there's an ask in what we're doing today, we're asking you to be equally enthused about an overall approach and work together to study rational solutions. We're not here with an ask to say 5938 is what it needs to be and 0.75 in at-risk adjustment and 0.90. That's what our research has suggested, but we really believe that we could benefit from additional study on this.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Kronquist?
If I could just add, Scott Kronquist, Association of Metro School Districts. There are other proxies that have been identified, but the research, I haven't seen research yet, including the article that Mr. Lundell referred to, and including conversations from John Myers, that would say there are better proxies. There are certainly other proxies. There are pros and cons of almost any of them. But in the end, I think John Myers argued that still the best proxy was free and reduced, partly because it's the most readily available in data, but also because it had the broadest base of support looking at all the research that was available. So,
on this point, yes. Senator Clark.
Thank you.
And Senator Worgen.
It's truly the whole issue around identifying the right data sets is a huge one. But having done a fair amount of work, particularly on the low-income end of this, our problem is it's not just that it's easily readily attainable, which is true. It also means that it's point in time. We actually can get it right away. It's not easily manipulable. I mean, that's part of the problems. And the federal government went backwards several years ago on some other measures that would have been easy for us. So as we're moving forward, we have to think about what kind of data can we actually expect to be getting easily from parents. And so I guess my caution would be, is everybody who uses free and reduced lunch at risk? Of course not. But it is right now still our best indicator. And so as we're moving forward, unless we really are going to invest and then we have to figure out how to get the data from the families, that's part of the challenge. So it's not just an issue here, but it is a big issue.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clark, yes, it certainly is a big issue, and it just seemed to me when you popped that up there, I wish I had been able to come December 1st, but I couldn't. It just seemed to me when you popped that up there that basically with the first two pieces you were going someplace different. All of a sudden you pop in the third bullet and we're back to same old, same old. We're back to one student at $5,938, and then the next calculation brings a student just because of the income of their family up to $10,391.50. Now, I realize those are hypothetical numbers, so to speak, but at the same time, what we just did with the third bullet is just go back to what we currently have.
Senator Worgen,
Mr. Chair,
I would argue that, in fact, what we're doing is we are looking at this with the production function in mind. All students have some common characteristics, and some students have additional needs. It would be in a manufacturing setting, my father could control all the raw materials coming in the door. But assuming he couldn't, he would know different inputs would be required in order to get to the same performance level, the same production level. What we're suggesting is that all students have base costs, and some students have different characteristics, and the investment in different students needs to be accounted for. Now, the free and reduced proxy for at-risk is what the research would suggest is a good adjustment. Rationally, we recognize that students have a lot of variability. All this does is it begins to account for their variability. The story I told on December 1st was about a kindergarten student that I ran into in a library who started to read to me. In fact, she wasn't reading, but she was just this far away from being able to read. And the third grade student who had just arrived in country who had no idea of what the language was and was a long ways away from reading. Both of those students are going to need to meet Minnesota's standards and the national standards. It is our moral obligation to teach them both to read. It's going to require a considerably different input for the one student than for the other. That's what this is. If it feels a lot like some of what we've had, we'd argue, in fact, same old, some of the rationale for compensatory funding was probably a good rationale. Was it sufficiently funded? We would argue it wasn't sufficiently funded. This is a more research-based approach to sufficiency. So I've anticipated, actually, my next bullet up here with the ELL adjustment by talking about the English language learner.
Okay. Just before we go ahead, I'd like to introduce Dr. Tom Melcher from the Department of Education, who is here and a person that we rely on a lot for education finance. Thank you for being here. Mr. Krumquist.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, actually, the Myers recommendation does depart slightly from Minnesota's current law. Currently, we recognize a free reduced student at twice the amount of a reduced lunch student. Myers would recommend that you identify them at the same level. I think his argument is that it's really difficult to determine at risk based on those two elements. And also, there is evidence that students move back and forth in those two categories based on the economy and a whole host of other things. So that actually is a slight departure from current Minnesota law.
Mr. Vandell.
Senator Stump, Mr. Chair on the committee, if we would move forward, if we'd say to yourself, what is this learner component about? Comes back to saying all kids have certain needs that are at a base level, and some kids have different needs that require different inputs. We really are suggesting at risk is one of the inputs, ELL is one of the inputs, and, of course, special education. Now, we have departed from the Myers research when we're talking special education. Special education under the Myers research was calculated at 1.0 value for all special education students. So if a student was a special ed kid, then that student was actually weighted at 2.0 under the formula. As we worked with the professional educators, the special educators that are a part of our coalition, they would argue that that's actually not as rational as taking a look at an actual cost reimbursement. The reason is because of the wide range of special education needs. Some very, very high range special ed needs and some moderate range special ed needs. And if you wait at 1.0 for those needs, you're really not looking at the actual needs of the students. Instead, we're advocating for a cost reimbursement model, which, for those of you who have been around this table for a long time, will look very similar to what used to be in place in Minnesota.
Senator
I'll pause.
Roland.
I saw a hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back on the other slide, you were showing 0.75 for free and reduced lunch and 0.90 for ELL. And I'm wondering, a lot of students would overlap with both of those. So how are you proposing to add on? Or are you proposing to take the higher one for ELL if they also fall into the free and reduced program?
Senator Roebling, Mr. Chair, we're proposing an excellent point of discussion. We recognize that the duplication factor needs to be smoothed out. And I think one would need to look at the needs of the child. The same debate occurs in the special education arena. As students come to us with multiple handicapping conditions, and what we do is we make a primary determination and provide service in accordance with that. As this moves from concept to construct, that duplication factor would need to be taken into consideration.
Members, we're handing out the full report. We just had copied, and so that's what's coming around right now. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roebling asked one of my questions, but a subsequent question, Mr. Vandell. When you talk about a cost reimbursement model for special education, that can vary from district to district for exactly the same student, you might say. Has it ever been discussed whether there were levels of need funding similar to nursing homes, let's just use that as a comparison, a level of need type of funding basis for special education students so that you could basically, based on IEPs or whatever that might be, say this type or this student that falls within this level of need requires this level of funding so that you don't have the ambiguity of cost reimbursement, which from district to district can be drastic.
Mr. Mandel.
Senator Wergen, Mr. Chair, in fact, I think you anticipate a lot of what we're arguing. But I would say if you take it one step further in, if you focus solely on smoothing the funding as opposed to meeting the needs of the child, then you set up what would be considered to be irrational circumstances. If it costs less to deliver the same service in my district as it does in another district, you would argue that I would get the same reimbursement as that other district? A cost reimbursement-based system really takes a look at the actual cost of the input as opposed to saying we'll just create a kind of average circumstance that may or may not fit everyone. Now, recognize that all costs in Minnesota are driven off of employee salaries and public employee labor relations act. So the state has got a leg in that game in terms of how costs are managed. But we're talking about a system that is a little bit more responsive to the actual circumstance of the student and of the situation.
Mr. Mandel, the reason I come at that one a little bit differently is because I've heard some pretty drastic stories of students that are open enrolled to an alternate district, and the district that they're open enrolled to bills back to the home district of the student, and sometimes what they're billing back for is just a little bit out of line, I would say. And so if you're doing a full cost reimbursement, you're really not controlling anything. You're just saying, design the Cadillac and we'll pay for it.
Superintendent Mandel.
Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, Mr. Lundell really wants to get into this game. So.
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, it's not a full cost reimbursement. It's a 65% of salaries and benefits. So every district has to have skin in the game. I think that you do point out a very big issue in Minnesota with the open enrollment, whether it's in the, or I say student choice options. It can be in charter schools. It can be in open enrollment. It can be any variety of student-initiated or parent-initiated groups, movements, rather. And I think that what we're trying to do, and we do have in here talk in our special ed model. I don't know if it's spelled out, but in the report or in one of our sets of recommendations, we do have a way to or talking about that tuition issue and how to get that smoothed out. My suggestion is that I think that we need to empower the State Department and give the State Department some assistance in its special ed section to be able to review IEPs in those instances and probably do more in terms of directly funding the district where the service is being provided, but to have some say-so on what the IEP is going to look like in those instances, because the state ultimately ends up paying the bill. But with the cross-subsidy, I think what Dr. Vandel was talking about a little bit, when you do levels of services, you're going to end up, because of the way the teachers and because of the way the negotiations go with, you know, different parents with different school boards or different administrations, that's really part of the problem with special education, is because the civil rights aspect, and I'm not saying to take away the civil rights of the students or the parents, but I think that there are the ability to negotiate for services, you know, in different levels of services, depending on what district you're in, you know, clearly does create some level of different service delivery. And I want to make sure, I'm saying it again on tape, I am not for taking away the civil rights of any special ed student or parent, but I think that does create, issues of difference. With that, we'll...
Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm also concerned about the cost reimbursement model. It seems to me that it limits our ability to plan appropriately. If we don't set an amount that we know that we're responsible for versus what costs just may come in at, then how are we to plan what our dollars ought to be? And then I'm also concerned that if we don't do a good job identifying what cost ought to be, and I understand there's differences based on the level of need from a level 3 student to level 2 student, but if we don't establish what a ceiling ought to be for each of those various levels, and also based on regional differences and what services cost in one area versus another. If we don't establish what those would be, then aren't we being less than responsible in terms of managing the cost side?
Superintendent Van Dell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I understand the need to be fiscally responsible. I frankly struggle in this area in my own district more than in any other area, because while I'm required to be fiscally responsible, I also am legally mandated to meet the needs of the special education children that I serve. And the most mobile population that we have in our school district is the special ed population, and it's typically the very, very high cost mobility. So consequently, when I hear discussions about the state containing costs, I recognize what that does is it forces costs back to the local level, and it typically comes at the expense of the regular education program. The direct cost reimbursement approach would compartmentalize the funding to a greater extent, and it would minimize the cross-subsidy that occurs. Whether that would mean that the state would need to put some mechanism in place to try to contain, that's a policy-level discussion. But philosophically, conceptually, we would argue that these need to be in separate pots of money so that the meeting the needs of one set of students who we morally and legally need to meet those needs does not come at the expense of another set of students.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me ask the group this then. What if we establish what those levels are in a formula-based system so that, in fact, we're not hampering those students? Because I am certainly not advocating, as Mr. Lundell said, I am not advocating that those special ed students receive any less services. But what if we establish a separate formula, just like we have a formula for our regular students that does take all that into account?
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, if I'm understanding you correctly, are you talking pupil weighting then, or?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lundell, I'm talking about an actual baseline cost for each of the various levels, and then the weights you may need to do something with regard to regional differences and.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I'm not an expert in this area, and I wish that Dr. Gary Lewis or Dr. Linda Wentz, who were members of our solutions group, could be here to provide greater insight. One of the problems in special ed is, you know, the mild to moderate handicapping conditions, which can be handled in classrooms of 10 to 15, and obviously there's the marginal cost on many of those students is lower than it is for a multiply handicapped student who is requiring, teacher's aids and far more intensive levels of service. I think, again, the problem you get is, you really have to start fiddling with the dials, I think, to get down to, what the funding level should be. The cost reimbursement model, and I think the other thing is that I've been told there are some kind of constitutional questions that when you start to treat one set of handicapping conditions differently than another set of handicapping conditions, you do open up yourself to some discussions of legal issues, and I think that's something we would have to tread, carefully with this. But I think we're sympathetic. I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, and I think that we do need. And one of the reasons we stayed away from pupil weighting and not, I mean, the Myers report said just add another 1.0 to this. I think special ed in and of itself requires far more discussion than just saying a special ed student's an extra 1.0. I mean, we've got the cross-subsidy. In the past, we've had remedies for the cross-subsidy. There once was a special education levy that was eliminated as we went to this base level funding in the 1995 session. That created another set of issues. But I think that there are solutions out there that we can use, or there are a discussion we have to have. I think the one thing that we're trying to stress in PS Minnesota, though, is special education really is it's a very important mission within the education system as a whole, and to just kind of lump it in as a weighting with regular education really does, I think, a disservice to the real understanding of that. And so I think we, again, this is another point where we're trying today to make the entreaty to say, let's have some, we need to have legislative investment here. This is clearly a place where that discussion, we welcome input from the legislators, we welcome input from the public as to how we're going to kind of take this apart, as Dr. Vandell said, and put it back together.
Thank you.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vandell, I'm not advocating for continued cross-subsidy or increased cross-subsidy. I don't like it at all.
I recognize that, Senator Wergen.
I would back up a little bit. You talked about treating one child differently than another, but it is possible to create costs. If you're talking about a cost-based model, it is possible to do a cost basis for some of the special education needs and the things that have to be provided. And that's actually what I'm saying. And I'm actually saying not totally dissimilar for what we do for basically nursing home residents and things like that. It is possible to do that. It would take considerable input from the special education community. I mean, I'll grant you, I can't do it. There's no way. But I think it's possible, and I think it's far more rational than just, well, we'll pay whatever it costs.
Okay. Mr. Vandell.
Senator Stump, Senator Wergen, I would not disagree with you. We represent my district and your primary district are very, very similar in nature and in size and all of those kinds of things. I am not a special education expert. And, in fact, what I heard Senator Bonhoff describing just a few moments ago was actually the system I was advocating as I first began to sit at the table. And I was pulled away from that approach by the special educators. And I do know we've got the intellectual horsepower in this state, and we've got the public resolve that we could come up with a system that's considerably better than what is. If the only thing you walk away with today is the resolve to say we can do better than what we're currently doing, and this might be one approach, then we've accomplished a lot. If all that happens is we look to the existing system and say, no, we'll just tinker here and do a little bit of changing there, the existing system isn't rational. It doesn't deliver sufficiently, and it doesn't deliver targeted at student needs and student needs tied to achievement. So, Senator Wergen, I think you're right. We come up with a better way. We have anticipated a lot of the kinds of questions that were here. I'm going to move over these very quickly to be sensitive with time. The cell reimbursement, the contract reimbursement, supply and equipment reimbursement. But the choice program reimbursement is something I heard referenced a little bit earlier, because the student that comes to you unexpected, comes after budgets have been set, comes after staffing levels have been established, comes to you with a choice program especially, is a significant challenge. And we have parents that are very astute and are shopping. As a matter of fact, a parent we dealt with very recently who came in and advocated very, very strongly for a level of program and services we didn't think were necessary, but ultimately we were able to cobble together a compromise. As soon as that compromise was put into IEP, that parent picked the student up, went to a neighboring district with a program that district has got to deliver, and there's no way they can do it in any reasonable fashion. The choice program, we realized we were being used to write a ticket to another place. That's what ended up happening. The state needs to have some more skin in that game, and maybe the new tuition reimbursement model that you're adopting is going to help smooth that out.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Vandell. Just I'm curious on that last point about reimbursement for choice students. Is your group familiar at all with what Florida has done with the McKay scholarships, and are you anticipating something of that nature where we would be funding students and families directly instead of schools and letting the students and families control where that money is spent? Is that kind of what you're advocating?
Mr. Vandell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, that is not what we're anticipating at all. As a matter of fact, we're anticipating that public schools in the state of Minnesota are required to deliver a scope of public services established in public policy, and that the public resource would continue to go through that public agency. So I think I said public a few times in that response, but that very much is what PS Minnesota would advocate. So,
okay.
Mr. Vandell?
You put the learner component together. You would say you take the students and the adjustments times a sufficient base, add special education, and that's what the learner component is. Now, it's very easy to say that, and obviously very difficult to do that, but nonetheless, conceptually, it's examining students as students and funding them in accordance with their needs. District Instructional Services component makes adjustments for school size, adjustments for location cost, and adjustments for enrollment decline. Those are essentially the three lead components. In a rational system, one would recognize that districts are different from one another. And Rick Dressen testified to begin with, and I was from Eden Valley, and because I'm alliterative, I liked saying Eden Valley and Edina, and so I got into a little bit of cost comparison between Eden Valley and Edina. Besides, we all like to pick on Edina as an interesting place to be. I would say when I was a teacher in Eden Valley, I was one of the poorest paid teachers in the state of Minnesota. It's a small rural town, but I was also one of the best paid people in town. I was. Why? It's because of the economy, the local economy. If I were to have moved to Edina as a teacher, I'd say to you I was probably going to be one of the better paid teachers in the state of Minnesota, but I couldn't argue I would be one of the better paid people in that community. We recognize that the economy has a lot to do with the cost of delivery. So what happens? Eden Valley Watkins could bargain differently than Edina could bargain because the cost of labor was different. And the cost of labor isn't the only differential, but nonetheless, it's a significant differential. From place to place, from region to region across the state, there are cost differentials. The state of Minnesota's funding formula accounts for those cost differentials in only one way. That is with the operating referendum. Districts that have higher costs can only recapture that investment by going to the property taxpayer. And again, the property tax differentials are such that it isn't necessarily an equalized way of doing business. The formula that we're constructing, that is simply conceptual at this point in time, accounts for adjustments in location costs. And I jumped to my second one. I apologize. I should see in the screen in front of me. One could also argue that that same variable exists in terms of school size. If I would look at Eden Valley Watkins again, I would say that, you know, we maintained class sizes in some cases of 1 to 15 or 1 to 17. Well, because sometimes our choice was a 1 to 17 or a 1 to 34, because if you've got 34 kindergarten students, you can put them all in one place or you can put them into two sections of 1 to 17, as opposed to where I'm at right now in Sauk Rapids Rice, I can divide them up more because I've got economies of scale. The research that we've done with APA adjusts both for school size and also for location cost. Now, the adjustments that are in the Myers report, which you now have in front of you, may not be the adjustments in a pure sense that we would advocate. We would advocate, however, that a formula needs to be nimble enough to recognize the economies of scale challenges and also the location cost challenges. So we would hope that any emergent formula would address those. And the third difference from district to district is the adjustments for enrollment decline. We recognize that many of the districts in the state of Minnesota are in decline. And frankly, the only reason why we have been able, as Sauk Rapids Rice, not to have a referendum in place over the years is because we have growth. And so if we have 20 new students coming at us at about $5,000 a student, that's about $100,000 that gets to go into our infrastructure. Well, our cost of a new teacher for that 1 to 20 is about half of that. What happens to the other 50? It helps subsidize the rest of the operation. That's nice if you're growing sufficiently, but if you're declining, do the reverse math and you understand the problem. 20 students leave, $100,000 leaves your system, and that's much more than one teacher. And so consequently, the enrollments that are in decline cause significant stress. We're not advocating a system that forever funds phantom units, but we are suggesting that the system that is in place that's rationally linked to achievement would allow a school district to ramp down those costs over time as opposed to just drop off of a cliff. So those three parts really put together, size, location, cost, and decline, would be a formula established predicated on differences between school districts.
Do you have any ideas about how a formula could be constructed to achieve that? The declining enrollment one has always been a tough one. We've done the average, or was it the average cost funding?
Or Mr. Chairman, in years past, Minnesota has adopted a three-year averaging approach, and that was phased out, I think, in the mid-90s. and we've now have the marginal cost people calculations.
Okay. Did PS Minnesota talk about how that could be addressed?
Mr. Chair and committee, PS Minnesota did talk a lot about how this could be addressed, and don't come to you today with a rock solid proposal. We've looked at a couple of different constructs, some of which look very, very good in theory, but in fact have never been put into practice. I said at the beginning of this that not all of this is cut from new cloth. We recognize that the state has attempted to do some of these kinds of things in the past. We really believe that with the analytical and the intellectual horsepower that you've got within this committee, your Senate staff is outstanding. We'd be able to come up with something that works.
Could you just mention some of the some ideas that you kicked around? There was one that I believe, I'm not sure who mentioned it out at the conference, but it was like a kind of a base level program funding for smaller schools.
Mr. Chair, there's an Iowa model that was developed in Iowa but never implemented. So, I mean, but they've done some work. I would also add that in the late 1970s in Minnesota we had declining aid, and at the same time we had growing aid. But I mean that was when we had, I think, 30 or 40 categoricals. But we do have a history in Minnesota of having a declining aid formula, and like as Mr. Nauman said, there was a 3-year averaging as well. So we've I think that there's precedent here, or there's been discussions on this. It's certainly not a new idea, simply seeing that we did have the huge decline in the late 1970s, and some of these issues were talked about then. So
there also was a study, I believe, at the done by a couple of people out at the University of Minnesota Morris on a kind of a base funding for small schools. And I think that was kind of based on somewhat the same principle as your approach, where I think the first 500 students in a school were this would apply across the state, I believe, the first 500 students in a school would actually generate more revenue than the average formula to cover the base kind of operations in a school if it was small, and then it, over time it would, or over above that, it would level off to the regular formula amount.
Senator Stuff, I am generally familiar with that work. We attended the Rural Policy Conference together, and that person presented at that conference. I'm delighted in the direction that this conversation is going, because we're asking the right questions. And we don't pretend to have all of the answers. We didn't come here today to provide specific answers, but rather to encourage you to ask the questions, because these questions are vested in a rational basis. They're targeted at what it is we have to accomplish as an education organization, and we're looking at a better way to construct the inputs, formulas, to make that happen. That's the encouraging part of this.
Okay, Mr. Mendel.
If we continue forward, Mr. Chair, and committee, you'd say to yourself, district instructional services then is the size adjustments, the location adjustments, the decline adjustments. The student counts and base amounts that we've talked about in the learner component are certainly factors. Then if you'd move to the district support services, I talked at the beginning of these remarks about how kids are kids, but then there are kids with different characteristics. Now, we just talked about how districts have different characteristics, but we also know that districts are districts. They also have some common characteristics. One common characteristic is the need for a deferred maintenance or capital facility revenue. Now, I've been around this business long enough to know we used to have categoricals, and then we rolled everything together, and is this good or is this bad? I also been around this business long enough to know that what I find is that in our own budget discussions, we have a debate between sufficiently funding our kids, our capital improvements, or our computers, and there are others that are engaged in that debate. But the reality is kids have needs, buildings have needs, and there are technology needs as well. We've been working with the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials on some national research that talks about the deferred maintenance and capital facility revenues. best practice would argue that between 2% and 4% of the total cost of your facility should be reinvested every year in things like roofs and boiler improvement and things like that. MASBOL has developed a square foot formula, has developed a per pupil formula. What we're suggesting to you is that some rational formula targeted at the real needs in capital facilities needs to be developed. In fact, the MASBOL formula showed on a pupil unit basis about $625 a pupil unit, or a cost on a square foot basis that would deliver that between 2 and 4% of capital every year to work toward capital improvement. Again, we're not here with the answer. We're simply here suggesting that this needs to be a component. Just the same, a technology revenue stream that sufficiently meets the needs of students and supports the infrastructure needs to be developed. Now, I sit on the Blind and Broadband Strategy Board. I recognize that there are different infrastructure costs in different parts of the state. Connectivity is different in different places. The system we're advocating would need to be nimble enough to address that. But we should not have the purchase of computers in a given year compete with the purchase of a language arts curriculum. And that's essentially what ends up happening in places like my own. Just the same, a transportation revenue stream that sufficiently funds the real cost of transportation needs to be developed. We've got another slide that will address that in a little more detail a little bit later. And, of course, we have desegregation needs across the state of Minnesota that need to be addressed. Not every district, not every place would face these desegregation responsibilities or challenges. Not every place would receive the revenue. We also would argue that in terms of state initiatives, state initiatives need to be universally available. Kind of the throwaway line in my speeches is pilot program seems to be the way that we're operating our schools today, education by pilot program. At PS Minnesota would advocate that everybody needs to be able to get on board that plane, that if there is a program that is that has promised to deliver, that should be more universally available and more fully funded. If we look at the transportation elements themselves, the state needs to more carefully define the scope of services that are going to be available in transportation. We understand to make sparsity adjustments for districts that have those kinds of conditions. We need to make certain that we fully fund between building and between district special education expenses and fund those out of transportation as opposed to stealing from the educational program in order to make that happen. We used to have, a pretty responsive hazardous transportation formula based on real costs. We'd advocate for a return to that. And we recognize that there are times when budgets are set and energy price spikes create challenges. You've considered these periodically in special legislation. We believe that the transportation formula could be responsive to those energy price spikes. And finally, we believe that there needs to be a program of fleet acquisition and make that a green fleet acquisition program in order that districts can cover the transportation costs. Now, if it sounds like we're compartmentalizing school funding, we in fact are doing that. I think there was a time when school districts were looking for pure flexibility, but what ended up happening is resources got tight, that flexibility purely robbed from the educational program. What we're suggesting is sufficiently funding the individual component parts of delivering an education system, and in doing that, you protect the education program as it moves forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, what is hazardous transportation funding? I'm not familiar with it.
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, hazardous transportation is a terrible term, but what it means is that there are circumstances in districts that require additional investment because a kid lives in an environment that is deemed to be hazardous. Say that Pleasantview Elementary in Sauk Rapids Rice District sits on some main thoroughfares and has railroad tracks that come right through the middle of it. And while we might not otherwise transport a student that lives a mile from the elementary school, if that student has to go through a hazardous crossing and across a railroad track, that's considered to be a hazardous condition. And so the funding formula is responsive to that. That's what hazardous transportation means. Brad, you were going to jump in with more?
You covered it all.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mandel, how does this square with your earlier, very early in the presentation, more block funding for district flexibility?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, that actually was Rick Dressen that made that presentation, and that was coming out of the task force recommendations.
Thank you.
Mr. Lundell.
Senator Stump, Senator Wergen, I think that you look at the governor talked about, did not talk about transportation or capital at all in their study, and I think that we do need to talk. I mean, block granting to districts for the instructional needs, but when we start taking some of the support services and putting those on the same negotiating table as the instructional services, it gets to be a real mess. And I think that the, as you know, and I think with, just to go on a little further with what Dr. Fondahl said, is that the right now in Minnesota, we're having a tremendous amount of difficulty in terms of transportation. I know that Senator Hahn has worked ardently over the years with the issues that are existing in Eden Prairie. With the way that growth patterns are going in the outer ring suburbs, the inability the kinds of questions about whether or not you transport this kid, whether or not you can charge fees, all those types of issues really do create need for further discussion. I think what we're saying is that transportation is a necessary support service. Kids aren't going to learn if they can't get to school, I guess. And there's a real gray, a large gray area, especially the way communities with no sidewalks or communities that are sitting on major thoroughfares, how those children are getting to school and whether or not sufficient resources are there to do that, given kind of the negotiations that take place between with that transportation money being on the table for all other needs.
Mr. Vandell.
Mr. Chair and committee, I remember very well the year. I don't know the exact year, but I know the time period when we rolled transportation funding back into the general formula because we were doing collective bargaining at that time, and it was the first time, and actually it was the last time as well, in my entire history of collective bargaining and from both sides of the table where the teachers said to us, you know, we're really concerned about the extraordinary cost of transportation in your school district, and they said it at the bargaining table. They hadn't been worried about our transportation costs until those two pots of money were rolled together. And in fact, our teachers are wonderful, they're good people, and we negotiate in good faith. But it just was the irony associated with the non-compartmentalization, the melding, the mushing of those two resources that really has caused challenges. District support services then equals the facilities funding, the technology support, transportation, DSAG, targeted initiatives. And so our funding framework is putting all of those things together. Student counts and the adjustments times a sufficient base. You add the special education component, the district instructional services component, district support services component. And that brings you through the basic program. Now, we've got numbers that we've identified for you, and those numbers have come out of the APA research. Those numbers are targeted at today's students meeting tomorrow's standards. There are other numbers that you'll find in the Myers report. A different approach would be taking today's students to today's standards. From an input perspective, it should cost you less to educate today's kids to today's standards than today's kids to tomorrow's standards. Why? Because tomorrow's standards are higher. So more manufacturing inputs would be required in order to make that happen. But we're not here also to suggest to you that the standards that are in place are what should be. What we're saying, however, is that we're legally required to meet them. If we were to move beyond the basics, this is what we would consider to be the last critical part of our proposal. Boards need discretion targeted to local initiatives. If a Board of Education believes that a certain program is imperative to that district, but it isn't considered from a statewide perspective to be in the best vested interests of all of the children of Minnesota, a board should have some limited authority to get at that. But that's to go beyond the base program. Just the same, if a district says, we believe that a given program like Mandarin Chinese, which seems to be what we're all talking about these days, should be available to all of the children of this district in a total immersion program from kindergarten through 12th grade, one might argue from a policy perspective that it isn't in the best interest of all of the children in Minnesota. It shouldn't be considered a part of a base program, but if the district wants to do it, the voters should have some opportunity to gain resource to do that. Limited, certainly, but for beyond the basic program. We would argue, and I think the data would support this, that almost all of the operating referenda in place in the state of Minnesota today deliver basic programming, don't deliver extra programming. And that's a result of the cost differences that emerge from place to place that aren't addressed in the formula. That's a result of the relative lack of sufficiency of that formula. The discretion we're advocating, we believe, needs to be equalized and limited. We put 20% total question mark. I would say to you that the professional literature would argue that it shouldn't be more than 20%. And the mix between board and voter discretion, we're not here advocating a position. We're simply saying that in total it shouldn't be more than 20%. Oops, I went too far. Finally, we believe that in terms of access to facilities construction should be equalized and that there should be state sustainability standards. In fact, I'm going to go back to something Senator Hahn mentioned a little bit earlier about state investment in local programs and just the whole notion that as policymakers you're responsible for a sum total as opposed to an individual circumstance. We recognize that there needs to be some economies that are associated with this. There are districts in the state of Minnesota that, with a reasonable sustainability measure, might not otherwise be in place. And we're open to the discussions about what those sustainability standards should be. If the state is going to make an investment at a local level, especially an investment that's beyond what it does for other places, then the state needs to see a return for all of the state stakeholders.
Couple questions here. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vandell, you've referred several times to the production function methodology in manufacturing. When we had our day's session at the university with the experts, one of the things that was stressed very emphatically was the importance of improving productivity, and that certainly is the case within the manufacturing model. Do you advocate that we work toward increasing productivity within the education system as well?
Mr. Vandell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, absolutely. We believe that we need to be continuously better than what we were yesterday. In order to be better than what we were yesterday, we need to make certain that we move beyond a constant debate about resource and establish a system predicated on standards, fund that system sufficiently, and allow the educators of the state of Minnesota to continue to move this system forward. Absolutely, I believe in increased productivity.
But Mr. Chairman, sir, it means that we increase the results with the fewer inputs, or particularly in the human resource end of it. Generally, we're getting more for the money that we invest in it as you increase productivity. And that's, I'm not sure that is the direction that this seems to say. We need more money to invest in more of the inputs.
Mr. Chair, if I could take a stab at that.
Mr. Lindell.
I think that we need to certainly make the system more productive. And I think that there's the analogy I would use here is that you can have a car that we can improve fuel efficiency and have all cars on the road go 50 miles to the gallon, but they don't get anywhere without any gas. I mean, and so we're trying to say is that we need the gas. And we need, and the thing is that to get the most mileage out of that, yes, we want to have an efficient car to do that. But we don't believe, given the task ahead of us, we need more resources and greater productivity.
So Mr. Chairman?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think there's a danger in using the manufacturing model because you're talking about, the productivity is with each of the human, the workers in a particular industry, you're getting greater results. The stress in education seems to be that we need lower class size, which means more personnel. The drive seems to be the opposite direction. So I think we need to be very careful about the manufacturing model and productivity because it is not the same.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Vandell and others. Similar to what the line that questioning that Senator Olson is raising. You know, one of the four mandates in the Constitution is an education system that is efficient. And as you've talked about this model, I've been trying to figure out where do the efficiencies come in a funding model that is based entirely on a politically determined measure of costs and then fully funding those costs. And going back again to the production model, that I came from a production background, and I do understand that you go through a process of determining costs, but those are typically discovered in a marketplace, and typically what happens is as productivity increases and quality increases, costs go down, as other ways are found to do that. So I think Senator Olson is right. This may not be the right model. But what I'm concerned about is do we have a structure that you propose that is going to give us efficiency in addition to other things, or is it a structure designed to simply increase cost? And I guess I don't want to lose track of that thought that we have as a constitutional mandate to develop a system that is efficient, that isn't just focused on driving costs. And can you address that for us?
If I could just interject, what you have presented to us, I think is, if I understand it correctly, and maybe you can correct me if I'm not correct, but it's kind of a collection of both of several models, which I think there were three: the successful schools model, the professional judgment model, and then the statistical analysis model. And so what you've done, or what you've tried to do, is to bring all of that together, and in those models, efficiency is definitely, I mean, you're talking about costs, and different models generate different costs and different outcomes. So I think it is implicit, but I could be mistaken, Senator Hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess one of the things that prompted that question for me is, if we look at, say, one way of doing this would be to block grant funds and say, let's put the funds out there and let school districts decide where to spend money to get the best result for education and children. But we've also heard that model doesn't work if you say, well, we've got capital needs and technology needs and needs in the classroom. And rather than try to give local boards the challenge of saying, you've got all these needs, but what are the things that are going to result in the best outcome for kids? What we're saying is, no, we're going to set these out and fully fund each of them. And in effect say, well, there shouldn't be that competition between those different factors to determine what is most effective. And that's what my question is. If you've got a system that doesn't have any natural incentives to produce that sort of self-prioritizing, then everything becomes a number one priority. And we, our education committee was at SciMath last week, and we talked about curriculum, and there's some real challenges there about, we've got this very broadly scoped curriculum, especially in younger grades, where people said it's a mile wide and an inch deep. How does that happen? It happens because the structure, I think, the system that we have, has every incentive to produce that rather than focus, rather than priority. And so that's my question. How does this system have an internal incentive to produce that efficiency that we want?
We'll have an opportunity to debate that. I would argue with you that the resources that the state has and that this committee is going to have responsibility over are not going to be able to fund all the requests that are here. So obviously our job will be to prioritize and look at it. But I think along with that, I think we do have to look at how well are we handling things like the costs that districts are incurring, and certainly a huge one that jumps out is a special ed cross subsidy. Another one that some of us have is areas in there that have either kind of washed away, secondary vocational education. When I was meeting with the governor last week, he spoke about that. Another one, and you can go on all day, every day kindergarten, which is a step that I think most of us would recognize as a very important component of the, you know, overall education. So I think we do, technology is another one. You have, Internet 2 coming on board, and many districts, some of them have barely gotten access to provide, you know, some services on a very basic level. So, yeah, I think the challenges that we have will be many, and we're going to have to look for ways of efficient or economizing and streamlining and maximizing our dollars, because we don't have the luxury of saying we have unlimited resources. So it'll come back to all of us, I think, in that. And Mr. Vandell, I don't know if I went on too long that you forgot the question or what. But
Mr. Chair, that's why you hold the gavel.
Well, maybe I should take this opportunity. I think this discussion is important enough, and I know we had set aside today for this, but if some of you can find be able to come back tomorrow, I'd like to follow up with a little bit more on the questions that we have, because this is a good starting point, because everything we do is basically based around the issues that you brought up. And then we'll move into the other issue that we're going to take up tomorrow, was the early childhood stuff. But Superintendent Vandell.
Mr. Chair, to what extent would Senator Hahn, would you wish a response today as opposed to? In fact, I make this general response, Senator Hahn. We are constantly, in any industry, doing a battle between effectiveness and efficiency. There's no question that is the case. The battle that happens in my district right now with the sufficiency of funding available to me, and this is real, is that as we're trying to reconcile as a non-levy district how to pay even average salaries to our folks as we move into another year, what we're finding is that we have to lop $1.5 million out of our program. And it's not a poor Greg or a poor Stark Rapids Rice story we're telling. But the decisions we're making inside set up the very competition you're talking about, because we've decided there will be no computer expenditures. We've decided that a curriculum project that has been 5 years in the making will not move forward. We've decided that my custodians don't have money for roofs and boilers or anything like that. Because we've decided that in order to meet the standards and to deliver to our children what needs to be delivered, they're the prime competition, and everything else is lost as a result. I don't think anyone at this table today would argue that what is in place is the right system. And we could argue that what we're presenting before you today might be wrong in certain ways. If you engage in a debate, however, that's focused on a system predicated on standards that the state and the nation establish, a look at real costs associated with meeting those standards and driving the formula forward in accordance with those standards, then I think you've accomplished something. You've linked your state constitutional responsibility to the responsibilities you've laid on the schools of the state of Minnesota through your public policy mandates.
We're going to pick this up tomorrow and start out for a period of time. I'm guessing maybe about something less than an hour, I think, for discussion and questions. You have that report, and you can have a chance to look it over. And then I'd also remind members that the session does go by very quickly. And I know many of you probably have fund transfers and or local levies. So try to make a mental note that you should have a bill drafted, because we will be picking those up and trying to deal with those at some point in the future. And with that, we'll see you back tomorrow morning.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. This was quality time.
11. And we have session at 11.
So,
please adjourn.